I'm sensing God's presence. It's been a pretty hard week in our household. Some of you, I think, got the e-prayers and saw that we had some sickness, probably some kind of stomach virus or flu kind of thing that took turns laying each one in the house pretty low. And as I saw communication going around the church, learned the number of others of you were feeling some similar kinds of sickness, and that stuff's going around. I don't know if it's preschool or what are all the things that make it spread, but I guess I'll just say it had me focused a lot on myself and my family and the challenges of trying to keep everything running, the preparations that come into a worship service and putting together a love feast. And those of you who've been part of those kinds of things know there are lots of little logistics. And a lot of you have had turns and have been working hard this week to make these things come together. And I know that they can take a toll. And I was just overwhelmed by the grace of God that I can come into a worship service with all of you and let go of it. I didn't know why I was getting so emotional just a few moments ago, and I realized, oh, God's here. God's at work. I've shared with some of you before about koinonia, about the tradition in the Raymond household of that family reunion. It's a precious time, and it's also a place because it's that retreat center, that cinder block building that was built on some kind of unwanted farmland in Indiana, just a few miles north of Manchester College. And this little cinder block became the home to countless summer and Christmas gatherings for our family. Because it was called Koinonia, and the theologians in the family, I learned as a child what it meant. I learned the Greek word meant deep sharing, and that it meant that sharing in the material and the spiritual sense. It was a place and a group of people, and I loved it. I didn't love it because there were so many spiders there, and there were lots of spiders, or the snoring people in the bunkhouse lodgings. I didn't particularly love it for the bluegill that my cousins always caught from the pond, and we always had fried up, and they tasted super pondy, if you know what I mean. I loved it for the time that we shared as cousins, grandchildren, grandparents, uncles, and aunts. I loved it for the rowboat and canoe rides through the lily pads, trying to find the perfect little blossom to put in a glass bowl on the table later during the meal, for watching turtles and frogs and dragonflies and all manner of beetles emerging from the black ooze from the safety of our hot, sunny boats. I loved it for the stories and the slideshows from my family members who traveled all over the world. I loved it for, especially as I grew up, for the deep and philosophical questions which my grandpa T. Wayne would pose for the whole group in a way that even the kids could understand. And the kids' participation was welcomed. I loved it for the friendly but vigorous debates about all things political and theological. I loved it for the singing, the guitars, the cello and the fiddle, and of course Uncle Dwight's piano and silver trumpet rousing out when the saints go marching in. So summer or Christmas, Koinonia was the place, the time, the magic, the very thing that taught me about the enormous breadth and depth of God's love. It wasn't until later I would learn the whole reason Koinonia was purchased by my grandparents and a few other faculty families was to make it as a gift to the college, to become a place, not really so much a retreat center, but a place of learning. Because there was this vision, it was understood that this land, this wet, marshy, kind of wasted, not so good for farmland land, actually was going through a metamorphosis, a change. This pond was getting dammed up by beavers, and it was slowly turning into what has now become a marsh and what will one day become a large open meadow. That transformation underway, an opportunity to watch it happen over years and to create a retreat center where people could come and study, get out of the classroom and really study the way transformation happens. That was the vision. I only now really am coming to fully understand it, even as I mourn the fact that we're no longer having our family reunions there. Today, on this Worldwide Communion Sunday, we reflect on the meaning of deep sharing, of the vision that connects us to God and to each other, and how we practice it, how we put it into practice in our lives. So that's how we get to our gospel lesson. Jesus and his ragtag band of followers are on the road to Jerusalem. Jesus had been talking about the rich and the seductive power of their wealth. He told the story of the rich man and Lazarus. Then he started talking about the nature of the seductive power of sin and the importance of confronting sin, of seeking repentance, and of offering forgiveness. Every one of these, challenging ideas. It's risky to confront sin. It's risky to have your life examined by others. And it's hard to forgive those who wrong us. The disciples are beginning to feel like it would take a miracle to be able to do all of this and to learn how to encourage other people as Jesus is doing to undertake all of these things. They'd seen Jesus work miracles. Jesus would say, "Your faith has healed you. Get up." If only they had the faith that Jesus had to them. Faith meant the power to work miracles. So they tell Jesus they want him to increase their faith. So the parable we have in our lesson today talks about the mustard seed. Faith, Jesus says, isn't so easily quantified. When it comes to faith, it's not about how much you have, but about the quality of what you have. When it comes to faith, it's not the size of your seed, but the quality of the seed and the soil in which you are planted. Well, mustard happens to have some pretty good qualities. It's pungent, it's bold, it burns. You can raise a little bead of sweat right there on your brow if you get too much of it. It's bright yellow. It works well as a dye or as a stain on your white clothing, especially. It's prolific. Weedy, even. And it grows into the biggest shrub in the garden. It's giant, especially when you consider its growth in proportion to the size of its seed. Jesus says that's what real faith looks like. When you meet someone with faith like a mustard seed, you know it. These are the prophets, the folks who have a foot in the world as it is and who lift our vision toward the world as it should be, could be, and will be when we all take hold of that prize together. The disciples have enough faith, Jesus says. What you lack is the will to live out the full possibilities of that faith. What you lack is the character that comes when you've suffered with those who suffer the most. And when you've gotten over your pretensions at success or prestige or being proper. And to muddy the waters further, Jesus goes on to tell a story about a slave and a servant. A story that we might just acknowledge is a little difficult, makes us a little uncomfortable with maybe the attitude it suggests toward how we treat servants. So I think at this point we should just step back briefly, because it's hard when we study passages like these just on their own. Jesus has been using a stream of mustard seed-like interactions and parables to get people out of their conventional thinking. The stories are bold and spicy. Jesus here is clearly not trying to legitimize slavery or indentured servanthood or gross income inequality. Jesus is using irony and humor. To his audience, to his followers, to the disciples, these commoners, they're farmers, laborers, fishing folk, servants themselves. Imagine, he says, imagine you're a master, right? Oh, now there's a thought. I bet people perked up when they heard that. What's Jesus going to say? Imagine you're a master, right? What are you going to do? How are you going to treat your servant? Well, everybody knew how a master treats the servant. But he doesn't stop there. He points toward an attitude, a character. He says, the servant does not build credit by doing what he or she is supposed to do. We are the disciples. We have pledged our allegiance to Jesus, and we are to be the servants. That's where we find ourselves in this analogy. We don't build up the credit by doing what we're supposed to do. It's as if Jesus is trying to say to us today, don't misunderstand about the nature of faith. Faith is not what gives us magical powers. It is what allows us to move forward into something that seems impossible. It teaches us to serve, not because we'll be building up for ourselves honor or credit or status. Faith is what reveals that no matter how obedient we are, we will never rise above the role of servant. For in that capacity, we serve. We love all of our days, and there can be no greater glory. By this faith, we can see that our salvation is not earned, but freely given by love. Faith, like service, should point us toward God. We are rewarded out of grace, not for the good that we do, for our faith is an action. It is lived in service and in community. Faith is the opening of our hearts, souls, and mind to the possibilities that are born of God's power. Faith is what points us toward God, toward the presence and activity of God, in whom nothing is impossible. As I was preparing for today's sermon, I came across an article in yesterday's Washington Post. The headline, "Her son shot their daughters 10 years ago. Then these Amish families embraced her as a friend." Do you remember hearing about that shooting? I want to share with you the story, because it points to the power of faith. A single word in black cursive font hangs above a large double-pane window in Terry Roberts' sunroom. It says, "Forgiven." The word and the room itself, a gift built by her Amish neighbors just months after the unimaginable occurred, is a daily reminder of all that she's lost and all that she's gained these past 10 years. The simple, quiet, rural life she knew shattered on October 2, 2006, when her eldest son, Charles Carl Roberts IV, walked into a one-room Amish schoolhouse on a clear, unseasonably warm Monday morning. The 32-year-old husband and father of three young children ordered the boys and adults to leave. He tied up 10 little girls between the ages of 6 and 13 and shot them, killing five and injuring the others before killing himself. Terry Roberts' husband thought they'd have to move far away. He knew what people thought of parents of mass murderers. He believed they would be ostracized in their community, blamed for not knowing the evil their child was capable of. But in the hours after the massacre, as Amish parents still waited in a nearby barn for word about whether their daughters had survived, an Amish man named Henry arrived at the Roberts home with a message. Their families did not see the couple as enemies. Rather, they saw them as parents who were grieving the loss of their child, too. Henry put his hand on the shoulder of Terry Roberts' husband and called him a friend. The world watched in amazement as, on the day of their son's funeral, nearly 30 Amish men and women, some the parents of the victims, came to the cemetery and formed a wall to block out the media cameras. Parents whose daughters had died at the hand of their son approached the couple after the burial and offered condolences for their loss. Then, just 4 weeks after the shooting, the couple was invited to meet with all the families in the local fire hall. One mother held Robert's gaze as both women's eyes blurred with tears. They were all grieving. They were all struggling to make sense of the senseless. But the Amish did more than forgive the couple. They embraced them as part of their community. When Roberts underwent treatment for stage 4 breast cancer in December, one of the girls who survived the massacre helped clean her home before she returned from the hospital. A large yellow bus arrived at her home around Christmas, and Amish children piled inside to sing her Christmas carols. "The forgiveness is there. There's no doubt they forgive," Robert said. Stephen Nolte, a professor of Amish studies at Elizabethtown College, our own Church of the Brethren College, said that for most people, forgiveness and acceptance come at the end of a long emotional process, but the Amish forgive first and then every day work through the emotions of it. This decisional forgiveness opened a space for Roberts to offer her friendship, which normally in their situation would be uncomfortable, he said. 10 years later, the Amish families are still consciously deciding to forgive every day. About 6 miles from the Roberts home, down narrow country roads lined with corn stalks and corn and crop fields, the small village of Nickel Mines is visually unchanged, except that where there was once a schoolhouse by the road, there is now just overgrown grass. Any of the school children were not yet born or are too young to remember. But it is impossible to forget. In one home, a 16-year-old girl sits immobile in her wheelchair, unable to speak or feed herself. Nearby, a 23-year-old man sits at his kitchen table, also struggling to speak. He just can't find the words to express the emotional pain he's felt every day for the past 10 years. Rosanna King was among the youngest in her class that day. She was 6. Aaron Esch Jr., then 13, was the oldest. Roberts has developed bonds with both of them. It started at a summer picnic in her sprawling backyard. It was only 9 months after her son's attack on their children when Roberts invited the Amish families to her home for a get-together. Talk about courage. They all came, including Rosanna. Roberts, a grandmother, held Rosanna in her arms, rocking her and singing her lullabies. Several months later, Roberts had all the women back to her home for a tea, a gathering that's now become an annual tradition. As she played again with Rosanna, she asked the girl's mother if she might help care for her. In the intervening years, Roberts spent nearly every Thursday evening at the King family farm, bathing and reading and attending to Rosanna until her bedtime. After the first couple visits, Robert said she would cry uncontrollably the entire drive home, overwhelmed by the reality that this little girl was severely handicapped because of her son. That's not lost on Rosanna's father either. There's never an evening that Roberts is there visiting that Christ King doesn't think of what her son did. But he said it never changes the goodwill he feels toward her. Roberts has cut back on her visits because of her illness. On this Thursday evening, it is King who adjusts the wide-rim black glasses on his daughter's face and shifts the blanket over her lap. He unhooks her IV to replace the bag of fluids. Rosanna barely moves, staring straight ahead, mouth agape, exposing a full set of braces like any other teenage girl. For King, forgiveness has not come easily. Some parents have mourned the death of their daughters. Others have seen their daughters fully heal. His daughter survived, but also he lost her. Every day he fights back his anger. Every day he has to forgive again. Sitting in a folding chair with Rosanna's hospital bed in view behind him, King speaks slowly, methodically, measuring each word. There are joy-filled moments with their daughter, like the time when she seems to perk up when he comes home from work. But then there are days she has seizures or she's up in the night and can't be comforted. I've always said and continue to say, we have a lot of hard work to be what the people brag about us to be. But then he says this of Roberts. She's strong enough, has enough of a backbone to go out and become such a part of the life of a girl that her son tried to kill. She's so much a part of our routine that there's something missing when she's not there. She's welcome here anytime. Aaron's trauma is less visible. Since the morning of the shooting, when he and the other boys ran for help, he has struggled with crippling anxiety over his guilt that as the oldest boy in the class, he didn't protect the girls. Even when a state trooper assured him there was nothing he could have done, it took him a long time to forgive himself. he started overeating. And when he gained weight rapidly, he stopped eating, eventually having to be hospitalized for anorexia. At the picnic in 2007, Roberts knew Aaron was suffering, which made it all the more moving when, at the end of the party, he told her he'd had fun. Since then, she's developed a special affection for Aaron, a quiet, contemplative man. He traveled with her to Ohio, where she gave a talk about her story. In her presence, he found his voice, getting up with her to share his experience, but he hasn't really been able to share since. Aaron is tall and lean, boyishly handsome, with the same bowl-cut hairstyle he had when he was young, his brown hair streaked blonde from hours doing construction work in the sun. Sitting in his home one evening, he strains to find the words to articulate what he's feeling. There are still times around this time of year when you think, why did this have to happen? And you catch yourself, or you can become bitter real quick. I don't know if I've had complete peace with it. I don't know. I think I'm struggling more than I realize, and I don't want to admit it. Roberts worries about him, how he internalizes everything. He worries about her, too. He sends her messages letting her know when he's going away with friends or checking to see how she's feeling, but he hasn't seen her in a few months. I don't want her to see me struggling, he said. I want to be her friend, but I don't want to hurt her. Over the past 10 years, she's been the biggest inspiration to us all. For sure, we all had it tough, but I can't imagine being in her shoes. I just can't imagine. It's a gray, chilly morning when Roberts, now 65, sits in her sunroom, sipping tea days before the 10th anniversary of her son's massacre. The walls and shelves in Roberts' home are like any other proud mother's, filled with photos of her children and grandchildren. Her oldest son's engagement photo is still there, as are pictures of him as a boy, but there's one small picture frame she's hidden in a drawer, the only photo she has of her oldest son alone. In it, he's wearing glasses and a baseball hat and not looking directly at the camera. She normally has it out on her kitchen table, but she hides it away when her Amish friends come over. They'd just been there for tea Monday. They don't need to have that in their face, Robert says. Nothing about her new reality, about coming to terms with her son's demons, has been easy, but it would have been unthinkably harder without her Amish friends. No one could ever imagine on that day that something like this would be formed from it, she said. Because of the response of forgiveness, we've been able to heal. The thing that's most important about our faith is not how much of it we have. It's about its character. It's about where we let it bear fruit. It's about our relationship to our faith, to God, and to each other. Our faith is what gives shape to the life we live. It's the only thing capable of healing some kinds of brokenness. My prayer today for our congregation on this Worldwide Communion Sunday is that our mustard seed faith be planted in the soil of this community with such faith that God's healing and reconciling power would be boldly known by all within these walls, in our community, and in the whole world. Some will turn faith into a test of doctrine, theology. Are we in the right group? Are we in the know? We must rebuke such distortions and embrace those who know the kind of brokenness for which Jesus came to heal. May we be a people of peace, of mercy, and compassion. Amen.